Hey, Internet. He's John. I'm Mark. This is The Enthusiasticast, the web show where we always endorse an awesome book. This week, special guest Emily Mandel is enthusiastic about After Midnight by Irmgard Kuhn. John, it's been a while. It's nice to be back in the saddle. How have you been holding up?
I don't know what happened. I downloaded Tiny Wings for my phone. I thought I was playing for what seemed like a short while. I looked up. It was the middle of August. You know, Walkman had won something involving straw and London was on fire. It was very upsetting. But, you know, we're back. So all is well.
An impromptu break. So I'd like to welcome author Emily Mandel to the show. She's the author of Last Night in Montreal and The Singer's Gun, both from Unbridled Books. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I'm curious about the St. John part of your name. Is that like a double barrel last name? Is that a middle name? Did I just say your name wrong? What's going on?
No, it often gets mistaken for a double barrel last name. So I'm sometimes on bookshelves under Mandel, sometimes St. John. But it is actually my middle name. That was my grandmother's maiden name. So it got given to me as a kid, I guess, to keep the name going through the family. So, yeah, it's a long one. Emily St. John then.
I mean, you seem to be incredibly, incredibly busy. You're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, you have a website and a Tumblr blog, and you write for the millions. And I read an interview with you that was about a year old in which you said that you have a day job as an administrator in a cancer research lab. Is that still?
Exactly.
So your day job is curing cancer.
My day job is filing packing slips, but yeah, curing cancer.
But that contributes to curing cancer.
Right, there you go, okay.
So, you know, and you're writing your third book. And then I read an article that you wrote on The Millions about Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, in which you talked about, you know, I mean, the subject of that book was the way that internet use affects our brain, and you sort of personalized it, and you talked about how your own internet use, you know, was affecting the way that you worked, and, you know, attempts that you had made to try and manage that. And I was just wondering, like, have you been able to sort of synthesize all of this into some kind of workable whole? Because that seems to me to be the professional nut to crack of the 21st century, right? Is how to make all of this go together.
Absolutely. Yeah. It takes a lot of work to integrate it all. I think that I have come up with a workable solution. Now, there's this program called Freedom that I recommend to everybody. MaxFreedom.com. And what it does is you set the number of minutes that you want the internet to disappear. And you can turn off the internet for up to 8 hours. So if you're somebody like me who has a lot of revisions to do and you're lacking willpower, then you can make the internet completely unavailable for hours at a time. So I find that really helpful. Another thing is that my day job is only 17.5 hours a week. So I still get a lot of time in there. So, you know, I'm pretty busy, but I'm not frantic.
Right. So it's basically, you know, just sort of putting the internet on the high shelf so you can't get at it and then buckling down and doing other things.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It forces me to do, you know, non-Twitter things. Yeah.
That's excellent.
So how did you get connected with Unbridled, right? So Last Night in Montreal came out in 2009. I was just kind of curious as to the road to publication for that. Like,
long road. What happened was sometime around, I guess it would have been 2005, I had what I thought was a reasonably coherent draft of Last Night in Montreal. It had a different title at the time. So I started querying agents. I found a directory that somebody had put together online where they'd ranked various agencies and the agents therein, and what they thought was order from best to worst. You know, started out with William Morris and went all the way down from there. So I just started cold querying agents from that list. And the 13th or 14th one I queried was this really wonderful woman named Emily Jacobson at Curtis Brown. And she read my manuscript and then rejected it. But she wrote the most wonderful editorial letter with some very concrete suggestions for how she thought the book might be improved. And there was really no guarantee of future representation if I took those suggestions. But they made a lot of sense to me. So I thought, well, in the worst-case scenario, I'll have a better book. It's worth doing. So I spent about 6 months revising and then sent the book to Emily again. And this time she took me on as a client. And then the state of the industry being what it was, it took about 2 years to sell. It takes it can take a really long time for a debut novel that nobody's ever heard of. So Unbridled was just the press that she came to, you know, at the end, towards the end of this very long process of trying to find a home for the book. And I really feel lucky, you know, that I ended up with them. It's a small press. There's a lot of attention, very good sales and marketing team, and my editor is wonderful. So, yeah, so it worked out really well for Last Night in Montreal, and then The Singer's Gun came out a year later. And now I've got this third book, which still doesn't have a title. It's going to come out sometime in 2012 in the same press.
Yeah, just announced on the blog or whatever, but like no sophomore curse for you. You're like right in there with Singer's Gun a mere year later.
Got really lucky. And you know, I'm not quite as prolific as I look, I have to say, because it did just take 2 years to sell a first novel. So during that period, I was writing The Singer's Gun, which I think is good because a lot of writers talk about the tremendous pressure that they feel once they have an audience when they're working on the second novel. And I guess they really just put that off, held it for the third novel, not the second. But yeah, it was really good to have The Singer's Gun just about done by the time I sold Last Night in Montreal.
So is that something that you've been more aware of with the third novel? Because like you said, you didn't have an audience that you were aware of when you were writing the second novel. Now that you're writing the third, like, has that changed how you approach the work?
A little bit. Yeah. You know, you have to just not think about what other people will think of the work. But that is such a mind trick. You know, it's really hard to pull off.
You need a freedom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you have to just pretend
map where of
nobody
the,
else
the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I have read and enjoyed Last Night in Montreal. I'm not familiar with The Singer's Gun. I know what it's about, but I was just wondering if you could summarize what you were trying to do in that novel.
In The Singer's Gun?
Yeah.
I really saw it as a book about what it means to be an honorable person in the world. You know, there was a story that I was really fascinated by when I was a kid. We had a family friend. He's one of these guys who is an absolutely brilliant autodidact. So he'd read everything. He was a tremendously well-educated person, but self-educated. He didn't really have very much of a formal educational background. And at a certain point, there was a job that he wanted that he was qualified for in terms of knowledge, but he didn't have the right degree. And the guy had a pretty common name. So he did some research, found out that a guy with his name had graduated from the University of British Columbia a few years later with a degree that he wanted. So he wrote a letter to the University of British Columbia requesting a copy of his diploma. And to the best of my knowledge, that fraud was never uncovered. So I was fascinated by that, the idea that you could just take somebody's accomplishments, I guess. I wouldn't call that quite a serious identity theft, but, you know, it's up there. So a lot of The Singer's Gun is concerned with those ideas. I use that story as a little bit of a jumping off point. So the main character in the book is a man named Anton Waker, and everybody that he knows is corrupt. His parents are dealers in stolen goods. His first job is actually a partnership venture with his cousin, selling fake Social Security cards and passports to illegal aliens in New York. And then at a certain point, he decides that he wants to be a different kind of person. And he pulls off a fraud very similar to the one I just described. He finds out that somebody with his name graduated from Harvard and writes a letter to the school requesting a copy of his diploma. But then, because that's a bit of a house of cards to base a new life on, things start to fall apart pretty rapidly. So, yeah, it's concerned with identity. It's concerned with crime. It goes over into territories of illegal immigration and human trafficking. I have a hard time summing it up, but, yeah, that's the basic outline.
Well, identity seems to be something you spend a lot of time thinking about, right? So there's, in Last Night in Montreal, actually, it was fun to see, like, Du Maurier cigarettes and Bill 101 kind of name checked, but it made me think in Canada anyway, like we did spend a lot of time in the 70s and 80s thinking about what identity meant on a national cultural level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of flipped around on us. And I think we as a nation are more at ease with the kind of plurality of identities brought on by the internet. But
right.
You're a Canadian person that's moved to the US. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if, being in the U.S., if there's, like, you know, there's in the U.S., being two people at once is more of a deception than it would be in Canada, or if you like would elevate that this kind of thing to that kind of level.
That's a really interesting question. I feel like in Canada, it's more that you're expected. You're expected to be somewhat conversant in this slightly different culture. Now, most Canadians have a vague grasp of at least a few French words. But in the U.S., on the other hand, when I think about it, there's been such immigration from Spanish-speaking countries over the past few years that I think we're almost getting close to that same thing with the Spanish language in the States. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it.
So we were talking about genre, and I saw that one of the Goodreads employees, Patrick Brown, compared The Singer's Gun to season 2 of The Wire. And so I was like, that's a good thing in my books. Is it a good thing in your books? And you were speaking to the genre thing.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a good thing in my books. I think The Wire is a brilliant show. So any comparison seems to me like flattery. You know, it's been really interesting navigating genre. Really, what I set out to do with both Last Night in Montreal, The Singer's Gun, and the third novel, which still doesn't have a title, is I wanted to write literary fiction, but with the strongest possible narrative drive and plotting. And kind of an interesting side effect of that was that it pushed me over into the edge of genre. So all of a sudden, I started finding myself being labeled as a crime writer, which really, I didn't feel like I was that conversant in the genre. It was kind of a surprise. I've come to embrace that a little bit more, but I think of it more as literary fiction with a criminal element, more than straight out suspense or crime.
All right. I have a question that I've always wanted to ask about author photos. You have an excellent author photo. You're welcome. It's a very nice photo, which is always a good start, but also it feels like the kind of author photo that you could put it on any book. Like if you wanted to write a comic novel or a gothic horror or whatever, that author photo would not be like a disconnect for the reader, which is a neat trick to pull off. But I always wondered, as an author, how do you feel about your author photo? Is it like your driver's license photo or your passport photo, or is it something else because it's like your professional, you know, they don't put your driver's license photo next to an interview with you.
Right. At first, I really liked my author photo. I'm kind of getting sick of it because I've been using it for almost 3 years now. But, you know, I guess it served me well. What happened was I had a session with a professional photographer, and somehow none of the pictures worked out. I looked like I was smirking in all of them. It was a disaster. And it was about 2 days before Unbridled needed my author photo. So my husband said, let's just go up on the roof with a camera and see what we can do. And he took that photo of me, which has been great. So, yeah.
Well done. It looks like that. It looks like you're just hanging out on a roof in Brooklyn.
That's what we were going for, yeah. An hour of taking pictures, but I'm glad it looks casual.
And then, finally, you're doing some upcoming appearances, and one of them is in Mystic, Connecticut. Is that the Mystic of famed Julia Roberts' Mystic Pizza?
I think so. I wouldn't absolutely swear to it, but I think that's what somebody told me.
You should absolutely have pizza. Have you done a lot of touring behind the books? Is it mostly over the interweb like this, or have you actually got to go out and go around?
I've done a lot of internet stuff, but I also have spent a lot of time on the road. Last summer, I went everywhere. I was in New England and California, Northern Michigan, of all places. There's some fantastic independent bookstores up there who kind of band together to bring authors in on tour. So I was actually telling it all up the other night. I think I've done about 32 or 35 appearances for The Singer's Gun, and then there were about 25 for Last Night in Montreal the year before. So yeah, it feels like a lot.
So let's get to your endorsement then. This is a novel. This is a book / novel. Is it a novel? I've never heard of it.
It's a novel. Yeah,
It's
got a good story. After Midnight, it was published in 1937, and the author is kind of a fascinating figure. I just wrote her about her on The Millions, and I have to admit I'm kind of obsessed by her and her work. Irmgard Kuhn, she was born in Berlin in 1905, and just led the most interesting and fraught life. She was a best-selling debut novelist when she was 26, and then by 1936, she was in exile from the Nazis. She'd fallen afoul of them. And After Midnight came out, I think about a year after she fled Germany. It's a story about a young woman, I think she's 19, her name's Anna, living in Frankfurt in the late 30s. I think the book's actually set around the time it was published, so 1936, 1937. And she lives with her her brother and her sister-in-law. And it's just the most beautifully written and harrowing and compelling portrait of what it was like to live in Germany at that time. Now, she writes about the unbearable pressures of living in this increasingly menacing police state and this incredible atmosphere of fear where, you know, neighbors will turn each other into the Gestapo, sometimes for real political issues, but usually out of convenience. Now, a shopkeeper might turn in a competitor and thus effectively shut down the competition. And it's harrowing, and the writing is so beautiful. She has this wonderful moment in it that I think about a lot, where in this setup, Santa, the 19-year-old, her best friend is in love with a Jewish boy, which is, of course, incredibly dangerous at that time. And so Santa goes out with him a lot, so that it'll be three of them instead of two sitting around in the bar. And that creates a slightly less dangerous impression to anybody who might see them. She has this wonderful line where she's talking about sitting with him in the bar. She wrote, bright light shimmers in the wine. The wine is sour, but they're drinking hot, bright radiance. I just found that so beautiful, and there are moments like that all through the book. It was published by Melville House a couple of months ago, and I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's just a wonderful work.
Now, Melville House, of course, has had great success with the Hans Falda books.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Kind of a World War II era forgotten classic by a German. A Man Dies Alone is the title in either Canada or the U.S. The best-selling one has a different title in one country and has the same title as the rest of the world in the other, and I can't remember which it is. But they've then gone on to publish all of his backlist, so it sounds like they're mining the same kind of thing. Is this like a lost classic, or has this been in print and around, or is this like a little bit of a literary archaeology happening here?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I'm actually not sure if it's been in print continuously in German, but I think it might have. The trick with this author is it's been really hard to find anything in English by her. But it seems like Melville House collaborated with other press, and they each published an Irmgard Kuhn book over the last year or so. So Melville House came out with After Midnight, and other press came out with The Artificial Stilt Girl, which was her second novel. And then there was actually a third book, Child of All Nations, that was published by, I believe it was Overlook Press in 2009. So all of a sudden, these three novels are available in English for the first time. It's really exciting. I think she's a wonderful writer.
So is it like sweet Francaise territory, or is there lots of social commentary happening?
You know, it varies. The Artificial Silk Girl, her second novel, it was published in 1932. And I guess in 1932, a character who was completely oblivious to politics was a little bit more plausible than it would have been in 1937 when she published After Midnight. But the lead character in The Artificial Silk Girl is absolutely clueless. She's this kind of ditzy, I think she's 19 as well, this ditzy 19-year-old that's sweeping her way through the bedrooms of the Third Reich. So that one almost reads a little bit like Sex and the City. Could have been said anywhere. But After Midnight is much more specific to the time and place. It's much more political commentary.
And is this a new translation or the first translation? Or is this an existing translation that they've just brought back into print that you know of?
I believe it's a new translation. I'm not completely sure.
Does the language feel, I mean, it sounds beautiful. Does it feel current, or is there, you know?
It does feel current. She seems to have been a writer who wrote in a very clear, lucid style that translates well. But she might have been a little bit ahead of her time in that case, or perhaps the translator is particularly brilliant. Yeah, one or the other.
Do you think there's anything in this that resonated for you as a reader in 2011 that may not have resonated in, say, 1984 or, you know, 1973 or what have you?
Good question. There's certainly the atmosphere of menace and the build-up to the war. But then when I think about the other eras that you mentioned, you know, in 73, they would have been dealing with Vietnam. And I feel like there's almost always a war and almost always a reason to feel uneasy if you're that, you know, if you incline in that direction.
Yeah, that is the sad thing. I guess these are timeless books simply because the world is...
The world's always ending.
The world's always ending. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, on that happy note.
Sorry, I didn't mean to totally
no, no,
your podcast.
It was me. I led you right down to that.
But I think we should end it there, maybe.
Okay.
Well, that's it for another episode. Emily, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you want to tell listeners where they can find you on the web and if there's any upcoming projects that they should keep their eyes open for?
Oh, definitely. That would be great. I have a website at emilymandel.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at emilymandel. If you happen to be in Mystic, Connecticut this coming Thursday, I'm reading with Vanessa Veselka and J.M. Toline at Bank Square Books. And then I'm reading in Brooklyn on August 30th. I've got details on the website for both of those.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for being with us. It was wonderful having you on the show.
Thanks. Great talking to you guys.
And thank you to everyone listening. We're sorry about the impromptu break, but we're back now, and it should be pretty close to weekly for the foreseeable future. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can comment on any of the posts at our blog at enthusiasticast.com, or send us an email directly to hello@enthusiasticast.com. And if you're listening to the show through iTunes, we'd love for you to leave a comment there, as it's a great way for other people to find the show. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.
Thank you. Very nice.
It was nice you had written that article about things not to ask at a I just saw that. I was just like, I saw that like just before the show, and I was like, oh God, I must read this now. I was like,
that was so funny. This girl emailed me, and she was like, I have a brand new blog. It has no readers, but you know, do you think you can write something for it? And so I was thinking about it, and the guidance she gave me was, you know, tell me about your publicity disasters. Which seems like a really bad thing to write about, because I don't want to make my publicist mad. So I was like, okay, you know, I just came up with this little list, and I was like, maybe 50 people will read it. Oh my God, it got picked up everywhere. It was like in a newspaper in Canada, and the New York Times ran it on some blog. Yeah, so it got like 10,000 hits, and everybody read it.
You just sort of stumbled into the sort of the two best things of modern internet journalism, right? Because it's a list, and it's about modern social mores.
Right.
Which everybody is just like, oh, yes, please, just give me a list of things not to do, because that is what I need to get through my day, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I wish I'd made it clearer. If I'd known how big the audience was going to be, I probably would have been more paranoid about making it clear how grateful I am. You know, you get a few inevitable comments, like, oh, this bitchy author must be really tough. She's got my questions. But yeah, it was just a lighthearted thing that I threw together.
Yeah, it didn't come across that way at all. Don't listen to those people.